With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, and welcome to episode number 6 of the Create More podcast with me, Ben Stewart. On this fortnight's podcast, I have Alistair Parvin, who, if you're not familiar with him, he is one of the co-founders of WikiHouse, which is, well, we go into it in the podcast in a lot of detail, but to try and lure you in, it is it's in like a worldwide online resource for free design data. So the idea is that anyone can contribute and they can put up a design for anything they want. I mean, they're starting with a house, obviously, but and then the idea is that once it's on there under a Commons Creative License, anyone in the world can download that design and build the design for free. They don't have to pay for the use of the design, which is a slightly controversial topic, I guess, especially on the understanding of like creative ideas and things. So I talk about that a lot. I genuinely, I know a lot of my architecture friends are a little bit skeptical of giving your ideas away for free. But I've got to say, after you listen to him chat for about the next 45 minutes to an hour, I think you'll be optimistically surprised. So he did a TED talk called Architecture for the People, which explains all about WikiHouse. And it's had, it's had almost 1.2 million views, which is mental. So it's pretty much the same age as me. So we start off straight away talking about the TED talk. We go into loads of detail about the WikiHouse, about how it started, about there's different chapters of WikiHouse. So he's kind of created, or he's co-founded this this amazingly open source architecture, which is exactly what it is. So if you're interested in that idea, then you're going to absolutely love this podcast. So we have a really in-depth chat, and you can tell by the podcast he's very enthusiastic about it, which I love. So yeah, I hope you really enjoy it, because we go into a lot of detail and it's great. So I'll keep my chat to a minimum, because we do chat for quite a while. So yeah, listen through to the end to find out who's on next fortnight's podcast, because I think you're going to be pretty impressed with who I've got. So yeah, I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and I'll see you guys at the end. The basic premise of the podcast was that it's called Create More for Reason. I'm obviously an architect, mm-hmm. and as I worked at Make, the longer I worked here, the more I realized that the kind of creative industry as a whole is so much bigger than the kind of the tiny little pocket that I've been working in for, you know, I've been doing detailing and building a building, and I came out of it thinking, well, I love architecture, but there's so many other things that I wanted to look at. And especially being here, I mean, we've got, you know, like publishing houses and all sorts of like special effects houses and stuff. And I was like, I really want to know more, but, and also other practices, you know, I've only worked at Make as a major practice, and they do fantastic things, but that's not to say that other practices don't also do really interesting things.
Yeah.
So the podcast was really my way to kind of step in and find out.
Expand.
Yeah. I mean, I would never get the opportunity to come and see how you're working, but I should say that that I'm just recording, and that we are recording now, and there is no, this is my introduction to you.
Fine.
So I'm sat here with Alistair Parvin. Thank you very much for coming. And I think, again, I was this was while I was looking to the bigger creative industry. When I saw your TED talk, I guess that's how everyone kind of is first introduced. Mm-hmm. And I do want to talk lots about lots of things, WikiHouse and stuff. But first of all, just, we're a very similar age, mm-hmm. and doing a TED talk sounds really cool. And was it fun to do? I mean, how did they come and approach you, or did you go to them and say, I've got this idea that I'm trying to?
It was strange. I don't really know. I mean, it's interesting what you say, because I think when we were at architecture school, myself and a bunch of friends, in a way, TED Talks were the thing that invaded the bubble of architecture, and suddenly forced you to step outside the fairly narrow framing, the very narrow framing or the applications of design thinking at that time. And suddenly you're having to think about economics, about behavioural economics, about science, et cetera, in these very bite-sized chunks. So it was a huge, it had been a huge influence. And we almost used them, myself and a group of friends, we almost used them as a kind of propaganda tool within the architecture school to kind of broaden the conversation. So,
In a way of like, have you seen this TED talk?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And actually, for me, one of the TED talks that, for example, just completely probably changed the course of my life was one called The Long Tail by Chris Anderson, not Ted Chris Anderson, the other one. And that concept, when I then, of course, read the book, etc., and that concept has, you know, probably shaped everything I've done. So that had always been there. And my friend says, oh, they're doing this thing in London where you can send in a 2-minute video about what you want to do a TED talk about. And I'd been actually really, before we'd even been working on WikiHow, I'd been thinking very hard about this problem of the fact that architecture only works for, you know, the 1% really, in hard economic terms. So I sent in a brief thing, and then I got invited to do a thing, and then Ted Chris Anderson happened to be there, and then before I knew it, I was being invited to TED. And this is all very well and good. The interesting thing about TED is it makes total sense from the outside. And you're like, this is great, I love it. And they've actually achieved a remarkable thing, which is to create a room in which you know, a left-wing feminist activist feels like they're on the same team as a CEO of a major corporation, which is not a small feat. That's not a fake thing. It's a real thing. It's a shared culture, and it makes total sense from the outside until suddenly you're there and you're about to walk onto this stage, and it's not just a stage, right? It's not just the red dot. It's the fact that they've dissolved the back wall, et cetera, et cetera, and it suddenly goes, well, hold on a minute, how does this make sense? You know, I'm going on after a yo-yo guy and before Amanda Palmer, the singer, and then after that is one of my all-time heroes, Larry Lessig. You know, how does this fit together? And you think, well, maybe I'm just going to talk and people are just going to look dumbly like, what on earth is this guy talking about?
I'd not thought of the fact that when you see the TED Talk, it's just you. Yeah. I don't see who's before. And the fact that you must have gone, well, I mean, what is it? Am I as cool as a yo-yo guy?
Yeah, no, exactly. And these insanely cool people. It's like, I'm just here talking about, you know, what seems, you know, maybe not such a huge thing.
And did you get a good reaction from it then?
It was amazing. I mean, it was completely amazing. And in some ways, I wish I'd known then what I know now. I mean, I did it with my eyes open, in the sense that we live in an extraordinary age, which is that previously, if you wanted to do something, you needed huge amounts of capital and money and et cetera, et cetera. Mm. If you were just a person with an idea and you were a bunch of friends, you didn't stand a chance. We're suddenly in this age where you can. And so that was, you know, it's like, okay, let's give this a shot. Let's put this idea out there. And we did. And but it has a cost, and everyone sees the cool bit. And of course, it also has a cost to it. I mean, and the warning should have been, when you sign up, you know, that you're filling information as a TED speaker, it says insert your PA's details here. And we're like, well, I can't even pay my own salary, let alone a PA's salary.
So you just put your name against it.
Exactly. It's me twice. That should have been the warning bell as well, because of course what you get is hundreds and hundreds of emails, and you feel like you've made this promise to the world. And I think that was a really thrown into the deep end, when suddenly you have hundreds of emails.
Oh, so at the point you were like,
people saying, oh, this is the greatest thing I've ever heard, or you're an idiot, or, you know, whatever. And then learning how, the hard bit is actually learning how to convert that into an actual thing with legs and wheels and a bank account.
How early on, we'll talk about WikiHouse, but how early on from you having the idea and developing it, was it years until you did the TED Talk, or was it actually
quite
quick?
If you speak to everyone involved in WikiHouse, they'll give you a different story about where WikiHouse comes from, and that's good, right? Yeah. There's another really good TED Talk, but I can't remember the name of the guy who gave it, who makes a really good point, which is that when people were cheering, you know, the speech by Martin Luther King, they weren't doing it because they were cheering because they liked Martin Luther King. They were cheering because Martin Luther King put into words something that they already thought and felt. And I think it's the same with something like that. So there was already hundreds, thousands of designers, young architects, who were thinking in this way. And I think WikiHouse just is the right framing, and they go, yes, this is what we've been talking about.
Yeah.
Let's use this vehicle. So, and I think even with the kind of core group of us who kind of began thinking about this, we all came from a different angle. For me, I had been, I don't know, about sort of as I came out of university, really, or sometime before that, I thought I was going to train to be an architect or a designer, and I accidentally became a kind of design economist. And I started looking into the economics of housing and why it is that some of the richest countries in the world have a housing crisis. You know, when you think about it, it's mad, right? It's not that hard to provide 50 million people with a house. And yet we're failing, right? So there's something in the economics that's not working. And so I'd begun to kind of study that, and I wrote a thing at uni, which was called the profit function, in which I basically argued that almost everything we think we know about architecture is rubbish, because just heuristically, you know, just modestly wrote out the thing. Because I was basically arguing that actually, if you look at the de facto purpose of most architecture that we were producing, we were actually working for real estate developers. And so what we thought we were designing houses, we were not. We were designing real estate assets for developers. And most architects don't understand that. They still don't understand it. More understand it now than did before. But hardly anyone was talking about it.
Because you had that great quote, which is form doesn't follow function, form follows finance.
Yeah, which, by the way, is borrowed. I don't know where from, but I'm sure I'll let you have it. I'm sure, thanks.
Take it.
I'm sure I wasn't the first.
Because I've always said that I was interviewing any architect that I've interviewed, that someone from Studio Weave, Jay from Studio Weave, that's where I was, and that's where I got your email address from. He was saying for his part one or post part one project, he did a live project that got built. And I was like, that is way better than any fictional project that I could have thought of. Because think how many different avenues that you learnt there that you didn't think you needed, but that's all you rely on when you come out of architecture school. It's like, it all just comes down to money and what the client's willing to pay for. And I think that's always been an eye-opener for me as well, is that any project, the very first thing you talk about is money. And I guess unless you're the kind of document that you did, it's really interesting, the idea of you looking at the actual money, looking at the source of the
exactly.
Contract.
And for, I mean, when I think you, I always think we could quite healthily replace the word design with purpose, right? And there's this lovely concept in Greek called teleology or telos, which is the way a thing reflects its purpose. So in my hand is a mug, it has a handle and a thing. I mean, it looks really clearly articulates what its purpose is, which is a portable puddle that has a handle, right? And I think as a designer, you have to understand what is the deep fundamental purpose behind your work. Otherwise, you're just furnishing something. And actually, this recognition that almost everything that at that time, this is before the crash or just around the time of the crash, almost everything that at the time most designers or architects were moaning about and calling bad design wasn't bad design. It was actually very, very good design if your purpose is to make speculative real estate profits. And so I kind of tongue in cheek wrote this thing called, Form Follows Finance, in which I kind of argued the best way to, you know, make a profit using real estate. And lo and behold, it's what most buildings look like. So I got into that, and that then had led on to the next thing, where I'd started to look at, well, what's the alternative? How do you change the values, the procurement behind architecture? It's stepping beyond the traditional space that you're allowed to be as a designer and saying, no, actually, we need to get into we need to understand the economics behind what we're doing, and we need to see them as something to be designed. And it's a really straightforward, simple thing. And I say this again and again, that there is only one group of people in the world. Every government right now has a policy to build more environmentally friendly buildings. There is only one group of people in the world who have a direct economic incentive to put more insulation in the walls, and that is the people who are going to live there and pay the heating bills. It's really simple stuff. And yet that is the one group of people who we've never taken seriously as a force for house building. We're completely dependent on top-down centralized development models for housing, whether it's the state in the 60s or whether it's the market, you know, real estate market since then. And so we don't realize that architecture's history, as we think it is actually not a real history. It's a kind of pulling along the coattails of this economic shift about centralized industrial models for production of housing.
As you said, it's like a... you were saying that... I've completely lost my train of thought. You were saying that developers... You're as an architect, you're basically creating for a developer, and you kind of the form follows finance thing is something that just really stuck in my head. And the way I see it is, I don't understand why it's not taught more, this idea of economics.
It's baffling, isn't it?
Yeah. Because I was actually just in a meeting where we said something about the design, and the developers kind of rolled their eyes and went, architect.
Yeah.
Because we were essentially suggesting something that was a lot more complicated and expensive, but we genuinely believed it would look a lot nicer.
Yeah.
And it was the kind of collective architect.
But if you don't understand the value behind what's going there, so I mean, I always, even when I was doing things like student projects, I got into this thing of where you start every project by going, what is the root question here behind this project? And there's that wonderful Cedric Price quote, we should be less interested in the design of bridges and more interested in how to get to the other side. And, you know, that's what's great about him, because he sort of set this path where you don't think about schools, think about education. Don't think about hospitals, think about health. So when you look through just buildings to the actual form of value, well, it's really, really clear what's going on. And again, it's not controversial stuff. You know, it's been written in government reports for many, many years, is that in an inflating real estate sector, a developer, by definition, is not there to build homes. They're there to make 20% return for their shareholders by buying land, increasing its value and selling it for more. And if they can do that without building homes, by the way, they will. Yeah. And often they do. What that means is that everything that we as architects and the public and the government see as good about our homes, i.e. sustainability, affordability, high quality, you know, flexibility, strong communities, everything we see as good about homes, they see as costs. Now, that's not because they're bad people. They're perfectly good, decent people, and go for a drink with them. You know, I'm sure you have.
Yeah.
Right? They're perfectly normal people. It's because they are in this old business model, and it's not going to last forever, and it's dumb.
There's also no incentive on them to increase production. I've always thought this.
Exactly. And this is one of the great myths right now in housing crisis, is that people talk about housing crisis, and then on comes some spokesperson for something, and they say, oh, it's a problem of supply and demand, let's release more land to the house builders. And as you rightly say, it's not supply and demand, it's a market failure. It doesn't matter how much land you give to a developer, no sensible developer is ever going to build so fast that the prices start coming down. It's like asking I heard someone say this, it's like asking a diamond salesman to reduce the price of diamonds. You know, it just doesn't make sense. So they're never, ever going to solve the housing crisis, because they're literally perfectly designed not to.
Yeah.
Now, instead of sitting around moaning or, you know, getting out placards and trying to beat them around the head, I think the beauty of being a designer is you take a step back and say, well, hold on, if this game isn't going to solve the problem, let's design one that will. And I think that's the interesting thing that's happening with design right now, is that creativity and creative thinking and strategic thinking is moving beyond just, oh, we make the objects.
Yeah.
We spend the money, to the idea that, no, we design the processes. We understand the value behind these things, and we can actually design those strategies and those processes. And I think that's what lies behind projects like WikiHouse, is where we begin to see, okay, there's a series of quite fundamental industrial shifts going on here, and technological shifts that mean we don't have to do it like that anymore.
So going back, when did you do the Right to Build? Explain what that was to people.
Right to Build was after I'd graduated. I graduated right at the moment of recession, which is in a sense a blessing, right? Because in a way it was, because of course if things had been, I'd worked for 2 years for Richard Rogers or Rogers Stuck Harbour, as they became architects, and it was just wonderful. Like, it was such a lovely place to be and work. And I think it would have been so tempting to just go back and carry on doing that.
Yeah.
And actually, of course, it wasn't an option. And so it sort of launched into this slightly more uncertain phase of, okay, what do we do here? So it's just sort of following the ideas, really. This opportunity came up through my former tutor to get a little bit of research money, and I could basically propose whatever I wanted. So I said, well, actually, housing is the single most important thing we could be talking about right now. So I started working on this piece of research.
How are you at that point? Why was that such a passion for you? Having come from Rogers, and obviously you probably worked on some amazing buildings anywhere in the world, to suddenly then take a step back and go, no, houses. I mean, I'm just saying that because you seem so passionate about it straight from the off. Like, what was it, a uni work that you did that was kind of, didn't you get an award for a uni project?
Yeah. I think, I mean, it's difficult to answer this without sounding incredibly pompous. I just wanted to be useful, right? You've got to find a problem that needs solving. And it seemed incredibly self-evident that, as I said, you know, we're in a developed country and yet we have a housing crisis. Mm. And actually, by the way, the more you study it, the more you realise that actually all the developed countries have essentially the same pattern. The housing systems are failing them in the same way. So it's just this question of being useful. Plus, also, I'm much more interested in the long tail, the many with a bit than the few with a lot. You know, I was I'm really interested in the history of the middle classes and the rise of those basic rights where we all got to have a house and a fridge and, you know, that which all the things that we take for granted. But there's this explosion. You know, if you look back at, obviously, America is the quintessential example. You look back at the history of Florida in the 1950s, the population explodes out of nowhere. And a lot of it has to do with two forces. One is retirement of forces personnel, and the other is the invention of air conditioning. And I think those forms of middle class abundance and security, the baby boomer generation had this amazing era where they had education, they had amazing public services, they had this idea of a steady job, the idea that you could affordably get a house. That doesn't exist for this generation. That's gone.
Yeah.
And I think that is a very real question of how do we create that abundance for most people in a sustainable, equitable way. That's a design problem. It's not just a politics problem.
Yeah.
So why would you just go and faff around on this, frankly, otherwise rather narrow industry of architects, I'll be blunt, making funny shapes for rich people?
Yeah.
You know, when there's so many other interesting problems out there, why would you do that?
It is fun, I guess. But as now,
I'm not saying it's bad, by the way. I'm just saying that it's one very, very tiny corner of design's potential contribution. And again, Cedric Price used to talk very eloquently about this, as you know, architecture needs to work hard to be as useful as dentistry or butchery.
Yeah.
You know, we should be.
But I think I heard you talk about this in another interview, was it does feel to me that like homeowners as a collective are either like that we're like the biggest cartel or a monopoly, because now I have a house and you're in the system, you're like, yeah, it's all right. But
My house going up in value,
yeah,
it's great. Well, actually, you say that, it's really interesting, because a year or two ago, there was a really interesting piece of research done by Shelter and one of the polling companies, I can't remember which, YouGov or Populous. And this was led by Toby Lloyd at Shelter, who's a really, really smart guy. So if you ever are feeling confused about what the housing crisis actually is, go and just Google Toby Lloyd and you'll find him explaining it.
I think I may chase him up for a future podcast then. I think
he's
his name forward.
Listen to him. Yeah, he's a very smart guy. And they found a really interesting thing in this poll where, for the first time in decades, the majority of the British electorate no longer believed that their house going up in value was a good thing. Now, this wasn't because we'd all suddenly woken up and learned how to do economics, because, of course, it was never good for us. Everyone goes, oh, my house just gone up in value. Well, if your house just doubled in value, it just means your next house also doubled in value or got half as big. So don't be surprised when Britain's building the smallest houses in Western Europe, of course, right?
Burst my bubble now.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, the only people who benefit from continuously inflating property prices are people who work in the property industry and people right at the end of their lives down trading. But, of course, they don't, you know. So the reason why it happened wasn't because we just woke up and sort of learned how to do maths. It was because basically the failure of this system has got to such a pinch point. The baby boomers always assumed they would be able to help their kids into housing. And suddenly there's a whole generation of people who realize that it's got so mental that they cannot do that anymore. They cannot help their kids get into housing. So it's actually the family ties that are this generational divide that is allowing us to wake up and go, oh no, hold on, that was a myth. It wasn't housing growth, it was inflation. It wasn't this boom, it wasn't an urban renaissance, it was actually a massive economic failure, and we've got to find another way of
doing it. I think especially in London. I mean, being so Obviously, having just gone through the whole process, just to kind of be pushed further and further away from the centre. If you look at where we've rented and then where we've bought each time, every 2 years, we've just pushed ourselves further and further back. And I think I know from personal experience, friends who are like, well, I'm never going to get a house. Yeah.
Or as you say, I mean, what I think is one of the reasons the housing crisis is so interesting is you don't have to be super poor to be being screwed by it. As you say, even people who are in a house are in a smaller house than they should be, or they're being shoved miles and miles away from their jobs or from the city or from their work. As you say, there's this sort of tidal wave of hipsters being pushed out into these neighborhoods where suddenly working class, you know, people are going, where the hell did all these beards come from? And of course it's all to do with property prices.
And it's just frustrating. And I think what's frustrating as well is that you see these communities build, creative communities especially, seem to be based around this kind of, not a zero pressure environment, but you get the feeling that, I did the triathlon on the weekend and cycled back along the Hackney Canal that goes all the way past the Olympics. And I'd cycled in the morning, I just used my sat nav and just cycled straight along the roads. And it was like dodgiest place in the world. I was like, I do not want to stop on my wonderful bike. And then got the canal back, and the canal was probably the most interesting cycle ride I've ever had, because every canal boat had loads of people in it. They were having barbecues and they had loads of bars and shops, and then I saw studio spaces, and like, it was so weird to have this kind of divide. But you get the feeling, because they've been pushed out, they've built this community. And I would imagine that the second people clock on to the fact, this is perfect, I'm going to gentrify the hell out of this area.
Exactly, and this is the strange paradox of development, you could call it, that, you know, for years they kind of called it the Bilbao effect, didn't they, when a funny shaped piece of architecture increases the rents. But for a long time, architecture has been part of a compact, which is, you know, about urban renaissance, where we made the city physically better. We regenerated the city, but then, of course, the objective, it was funded by the rents going up. Now, the irony of this is that you look back in history, and where did the most creative, most exciting neighbourhoods emerge from? Your Shoreditches, your East Villages in New York. None of them were planned from top down, for one. They were almost all emergent and, you know, adopting old buildings or made by the people who were living there, et cetera, et cetera. But most importantly, they began with low rents. That was the single most powerful thing you can do for your creative economy in your city, is have low rents. And of course, you start off with low rents, and the artists move in, and the creative moves in, and then on top of that, soon other companies startup companies start, and it gets really exciting. And sooner or later, the estate agents move in, etc. And then the cycle repeats itself, and so you have this kind of, as you say, this wave of creativity being squeezed out. But that, in a way, is quite a depressing picture. And another part of something that we've been looking at Architecture 00 for a long time is this question of commons in cities. And I think one of the answers that we sort of proposed to Number 10 and to the GLA and people like that was the recognition that if you really want to have innovation and creativity, etc., in your city, you've got to do something about giving people a low point of access, even when the rents go up. And I think, you know, back in medieval times, they knew how to do that. It was commons, right? A space which you do not need to have own, but you have access, rights of access to. And we've seen a re-explosion recently in the last few years of things like Fab Labs, of the same idea. That a space that you can just get, you don't need to own it, but you get access to it. So if you're a young 14-year-old with a crazy idea, no, you don't have to go and sit in a job that you hate miles away. You know, you actually can get access to that thing, try it out, and then maybe if it turns into a business, then you start going into the rental market, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, that's why I kind of... So on that bike ride, looking... People have built their own everything. It was like a real do-it-yourself, this whole area, and it lended itself such an interesting, unique view. You know, it's like, well, what would people build if they could build whatever they wanted with their own amount of money? And it kind of, that's what kind of got me onto WikiHouse, like just thinking about it. And I went to, the first people I interviewed was Assemble Studios, and went over to their Sugar House.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've been there.
It's beautiful, yeah.
Yeah, and but that was all built themselves, and it had that total WikiHouse feel to it. But you'll have to describe WikiHouse because I keep mentioning it. But what I liked was there's this kind of fusion of massive amounts of free online technology, huge infrastructure around the world to communicate with people, coupled with the architecture side that I love and am involved in, which is why it kind of seemed seemed so nice to kind of see that kind of full circle of going from Assemble Studios and then getting you to come and sit in. But to people who don't know, and you should watch the TED Talk, but why don't you explain what WikiHouse is, because it kind of leads on perfectly from that.
So in some ways, it's a way, in the most broad terms, it's a way of taking those forms of development actually that we love, because they're made by the people who are going to live there. You know, they're made with those sorts of values in mind. Saying, no, that's scalable now. That doesn't have to be too difficult, this kind of marginal thing. So in sort of wonkish terms, it's really at the crossover of several big shifts. It's the first thing is everything that's been happening to the web for the last 10 years, which is the web gives us the capability to share information freely and cheaply online. Now, that has a huge implications for design, because the whole design industry was, you know, this based on this world where we were just resolving the same problems again and again, over and over again, incredibly inefficient, because we didn't share information that we didn't. Suddenly you can share files, you know, freely online, so why wouldn't you? You know, so again, it's not that innovative. It's actually already been happening in the world of code and videos, YouTube, Wikipedia for the last 10 years. It's now coming to the world of physical things. And one of the reasons why it's now coming to the world of physical things is because of the availability of machines like CNC machines. And 3D printers and things like that. So when you look at the crossover between those tools, you suddenly realized that there was a quite fundamental industrial shift taking place, when we were no longer going to be dependent on massive companies and top-down supply chains to produce very high-performance things. You could suddenly put an amazing amount of power into the hands of small businesses and the end user, very, very low cost, to produce amazing things that customize. So in very simple terms, WikiHouse is a building system, and it's an open source building system. So if you imagine a kind of digital Lego, where everyone shares the digital blocks of a building system under an open source license, so you can just take them and build what you want with them. And then effectively from that, you can essentially print out the parts for a house, which is just like printing out a kit using a machine that, unlike previous prefabrication factories, would cost you hundreds of thousand pounds. You can get a CNC machine for as little as £2,000.
So someone who doesn't know what a CNC machine, you're talking like
basically
quite big, the ones that
it's a bit bigger than the sheet of a plywood you can get from B&Q, because that's what goes onto it. So imagine a cross between a home printer and a drill. Imagine strapping a drill to a massive printer, and basically you put a sheet of plywood on it and it cuts out any parts that you want. So it's like 3D printing, but unlike, it doesn't ooze additively. It's not additive manufacturing, it cuts. And the reason we started with that technology was because it's already out there. There's already these machines in small businesses all around Britain, all over the world. You can move to this distributed local production model. So we can move from this world where factories are incredibly centralized, often offshore or whatever, to a world where suddenly the factory is everywhere, where it's distributed, where you, your local community, your local fab lab have essentially a factory-like capability. And then you can essentially print out all this kit, and you have essentially the mother of all IKEA kits.
Yeah. And you need plywood, just as that's the most readily available.
It can be in certain economies, right? So it's plywood now. The idea of open source is you don't need to solve all the problems for everybody. You solve one problem and you allow people to share it. So what you need is standards. You need to have a standard that we all share and have in common. And those standards do already exist in panel products. So it doesn't have to be plywood. It can be any structural panel product. And, of course, there'll be more people inventing more panel products all the time.
Yeah. I did think that, actually. We're just doing up our house at the moment. Yeah. And I just saw, and we've got an IKEA bench along the back wall. And I was thinking, if you could just make that as a series of flat 2D shapes bolted together.
Yeah.
I was suddenly like, wow, there's tons of stuff I could build here. If you want to do any outdoor furniture, it can just be waterproof ply, and then you can just...
You can, yeah.
And I was thinking, well, I wonder if they've got that on there.
Yeah, well, you can go on OpenDesk, which is WikiHouse's sister project, which was really conceived around a similar time. And they do furniture. So that's what, obviously, that's what it says on the tin.
So how does... No, I'm going to talk a lot more about WikiHouse. I still love it. But I do want to get to, like, how does anyone make any money? But that's, so just keep that in the back of your head. But so for WikiHouse, because I'm going to talk a lot about it, because it has got me so excited, was I watched, you just did a little video, and you said, I'm just let you guys, we're releasing version 4.2. And I watched the video, and you had all the SketchUp models. And SketchUp is... it's got to be the most widely used CAD program now because it's so free and anyone can, it's so simple to use.
Yeah.
And once you broke, because you had like a full, like a two-story house, or two-story house, and but you ran through...
I'm literally about to go and build it on Saturday.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm going to go and join in on site.
Wicked. Whereabouts are you building it?
It's up in Warwickshire.
Right. Is this for a client?
It's for a client.
Got paid. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
I'll come back to the money. It's a total myth that there's no money. There's much, much more money in open source.
Okay, because I want you to sell it to me. Yeah.
We'll come back to that.
Okay. And I do just really want to make people go and look at it, because obviously you're here, so I'm obviously going to be really nice about it, but I do, it was...
You can be nasty as well. I mean, we're up for that. I mean, we should have a good debate.
God, I hate it. I saw it, and when you say Wiki House just kind of straight away, and that would be too complicated for me.
Yeah.
It'd be too complicated.
Yeah.
And then I saw you do the SketchUp model. I was like, there's so many pieces. Yeah.
People are baffled when they discover how simple it is, actually.
And then you just kept clicking into these group of things, and you went, this is the module. This is how you increase the width of it.
And by the way, even that is still very difficult. So there's a guy on our team now who's worked, and there's actually loads of people in the community, but he's coordinating it, working on how we use parametric models to effectively make that bit unnecessary exactly. You just say, I want a house that's this high, this long, this long, and an algorithm will do the actual writing. So you can actually think of WikiHouse as a kind of coding language for space.
Nice.
If you think about it. Or a language. And that's another argument about open source. Like, imagine if someone tried to own the English language and tried to get you to pay a license every time you used it. It wouldn't work, right?
Yeah.
So open is just a way to be much, much more efficient, because we all become part of the same R&D team because we can all speak one language. So you can think of WikiHouse as a language, and that in the future that will be, it is now, we haven't released them yet, be getting plugged straight into a parametric.
But what I thought was, because when I heard it, I was like, that's a great idea. I saw the TED Talk and then obviously researched into it more, and then... you always think, well, okay, yeah, it'd be nice for a shed. This is my initial thought pattern. Yeah, it'd be right for a shed or a study in the new garden, but you can't make a house out of it. Yeah. I think how complicated houses.
Complicate those.
And then actually when you said, you know, this will meet current building regulations, we're looking into
we're talking about technologies that massively outperform, I mean, which isn't hard because most construction is so stuck in the dark ages right now. But, I mean, you know, our kind of favourite boasting point is the prototype we built last year and the Store Street. We got the, and I mean, this is true of most of wiki houses you build, but, you know, particularly with this one. You got out a tape measure at the end and we measured the house. And the difference, the deviation from the digital model and the real house along the whole length of the house was 5 millimetres. Right, and normally to get that, basically you have to go to a German company. I mean, bluntly put.
Yeah, true.
But this was made by mostly amateurs, right? And that's the power of this stuff. It's like it's addressing this, you know, this thing that we always talk about. This thing, the too damn difficult problem. You can harness that complexity you can take that complexity off the table, and that's the power of what this stuff can do.
And so I guess I'm sure there's. This has been done hundreds of times before by different companies to make houses that clip together. But what I thought was interesting was you kept saying it's a platform, but you create rules, not to lock anyone in, but it makes the whole infrastructure of how it's distributed and how you work it. And you had set modules and grids, so like window manufacture. I think you're doing a wiki. It looked like you're doing a wiki.
We
window.
Are, yeah. It's early stages yet, and we'd love to work with. A window company to develop that as an open source product in their supply chain.
Would any developer, a glazing developer, really?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll get onto the money part, because that's what this stands again.
This is a ghost in the back of the room. Let's keep it there. And we'll come back to it.
And, but to see, I saw you build one. You built it in, I guess, this was like, I guess, a fair of some description. I couldn't remember which one it is. But then you dismantled it again, put it in the back of the lorry, and you had all your computers and everything in there. And I just thought, when I saw it, it sparked open so many other ideas. What if you can do that? And then straight away I was like, can you build double ones? Can you build quadruple ones?
It's Lego. You can build within the rules. You can build really anything you want. It's just the rules evolve, and you kind of, that's the power of the kind of you limit the rules, but then you allow within those. On Lego is the same, right? You can't the little circles on Lego that sort of knock you into a grid. It's just that now with the digital thing, that if you like. That grid is fractal. That modularity is fractal, if that doesn't sound too mental thing to say, i.e. it's modular all the way down. And so we're trying to build a language which is as product agnostic as possible. So it's not, you're not locked into using one company or anything. Mm. You can respond to almost anything. But by setting certain limits and rules, of course, you make other things possible.
So following on from that, I heard one of the things that I liked was this was going back to the Hackney Canal route, mm. and another talk you did was I was like, well, all right, how can you actually, me as a person, I want to go and build and live in one of these houses. Mm. I was like, well, surely the challenge in England, I'm sure around the world where there's more available land, it's land, and it's, I would imagine, especially in London, that proportionally the money that you're spending is just for land,
yeah.
and then the actual cost, but it's still very high to build a house. Yeah. But I was thinking, what, how could you develop a scheme in such a way that the land is there for you to build these houses on, right?
So, I mean, we have to be really clear about this. There is no hardware solution to the housing crisis, right? People will say, oh, why hasn't prefabrication taken? Well, actually, there's a really good set of reasons for that. Again, I'm quoting Cedric Price.
It was Cedric Price Day last week. You did tell
today,
me.
Today, yeah.
Is it today? Today.
Oh,
there you go.
You know, technology is the answer, but what was the question, right? Mm. And the problem is that we've been asking the wrong question of prefabrication, because you can go to a speculative developer and say, hey, I've developed a technology that allows you to build a house twice as fast for half the money. And they say, thanks very much, I'll just take a bigger margin, but I'm still going to sell it for the same amount at the end. And we saw that a few years ago. Do you remember they had the 60K house competition?
Yeah.
And lots of architects came up with very sort of brilliant ideas for 60K house, or a house you could build for 60K. Then they went on the market. How much does it cost? 250K.
Right. Well, if I was a developer, why would I sell it for any less?
Exactly, right? So the question is, well, who owns the land? Now, there is a compact there. There is a point where they cross over, though, because the question is, why don't we have a market for land? Why can't we get access to land? Mm. It's because we don't take the citizen sector seriously. We don't see that as a scalable force. We see it as too damn difficult. And the message of something like WikiHouse to say, no, it's not too damn difficult. And so it was really interesting, because when I was working on Right to Build, we get to a point where everyone would say, yeah, we agree with you, but it's too damn difficult. Or it was hard to get people to talk about issues like land procurement, the planning system, etc. And suddenly, the moment you show people WikiHouse, it flips. And they go, oh, hold on a minute, why can't I buy a plot of land? And they start asking those questions about saying, no, hold on a minute. Why do we get swallowed this state versus market debate about who should own the land? Why can't we get land directly to citizens? And so one of the other, you know, and obviously Right to Build was part of a kind of policy push in a way. And there's, you know, we were one of many people who were pushing towards the government to start taking custom build, or this broader term that citizen sector, seriously. There's been some progress on that, because now Right to Build was a policy that was consulted on. We didn't do that. That wasn't us. But, mm-hmm. you know, we were hopefully contributed towards that. I think the one big policy that I would really love to see is to recognize that this state versus market, speculative housing versus open quotes affordable housing, which is an increasingly meaningless term, it's not the right lens. It's not the right way to understand what the actual problem is. So what I've been proposing is a very, very simple thing, which is that we could create a new land use class in the planning system called C5, which is land for custom build. In other words, land which is non-speculative development, so it's direct development. So the land can only be sold to the people who are actually going to live there. So we're saying, look, developers, you continue doing what you're doing, but we're also going to make this parallel land market, effectively, which is just for people who want to buy their own home, to build their own homes. So we basically say, look, you should always have this right to be able to buy a plot and buy your own land, because what's actually going on, and this is true in London as well, is that the speculative investment, i.e. homes being treated as financial assets, is crowding out the everyday economy of people who just want a place to live.
Yeah.
So you don't need to have a kind of big state intervention that bashes people around the head. You just create a separate parallel market that says, no, this land can only be used within this separate land a kind of approach, which is where they get sold as plots to individuals or groups to develop their own home at any density, by the way. It's not just low density. And that would be really powerful as well, because it would give local authorities and local citizens the power to say, yeah, we want that kind of development, but not that kind of development. Mm. Whereas at the moment, you have this NIMBY problem where you just say, no, development's going to be terrible, so no. But actually, it gives people the power to say, and actually, that would be putting teeth behind ideas about localism.
And is that like it? So, as an example, say say you want to build one of these houses and you know you live in a rural area, but there's a plot of land, for example, yeah. that could fit 20 houses yeah. on there. Instead of, because the developer is one of the very few people that can get the cash together yes. to make that financially viable, right?
Yeah.
So you're
well,
saying...
Sort of. I mean, it's partly, it's very much a capital problem.
Yeah.
It is also a question of inflation because, of course, when the speculative capital coming into the system, it increases the prices out of, you know, so only speculators can now afford it.
Mm.
But still, yeah, no, fundamentally, it's capital.
So in that example, everyone joins together and what they all... This is. I was generally trying to think of an example.
No, I mean, not necessarily. No. It's in that case, it's just saying we create a plot of land where in the planning system, where the planning, you are not allowed to buy it if you are a speculative developer.
Oh, I see. Sorry,
right?
I see.
So you essentially end up two markets. So if you currently take a piece of land that's got an agricultural land usage in the planning system, it will be worth, say, I don't know, £2,000 to £5,000 per hectare. The moment we, the people, say, oh, we approve this for housing development, it leaps to something like £2-3 million per hectare, right? So we create that value by changing the same piece of land, but it's moved from one land market into another land market. So what I'm proposing is we could create another land market that just allows all these things to just coexist, but allow one to kind of outperform. To say, just say, look, if people start flocking towards that kind of market, the local planners will say, no, that's the land we need more of. Whereas the developers over there, they're still sitting on that piece of land, so they don't need more land. And so it gets rid of this market versus state thing, saying, well, no, there's lots of different markets.
And are there examples of people that... Is this a new thing that you're proposing? Or
well, no, this piece of legislation is, but everything else, you know, is already tried and proven. You know, the Dutch have absolutely demonstrated the power of what you could call a kind of micro plan as opposed to a master plan, where within places like Almere, you know, they divided the site up into many plots and sold them off to custom builders. And of course, lo and behold, what you get is a really quickly developed, quite really sustainable, beautiful house, you know, neighborhood full of quite characterful homes, etc., etc.
And I guess the advantage of that is when all your capital is invested in the bricks and mortar, it's just a plot of land, then when you leave, well, that house gets taken down.
It can do, which is how the Japanese work. So people, you know, if you're an architect, if you ever wondered why it is that all the beautiful houses on the cover of architecture magazines are from Japan, well, there's a really good reason for that. It's because in the suburbs of Japan, this is how housing is procured. It's very much independently from the land. So those houses are procured by the people who are going to live there. And so because there is a culture that you just, yeah, the land, you buy a plot of land and you might change the house every n number of years or whatever.
Mm.
Of course, what you end up with is beautiful design.
Yeah. I guess you're... Some people would be thinking, well, I don't want to live there because they might build like a pink monstrosity next to my house. And you're like, sure, but actually...
Well, not sure, no. I mean, because people think it's one or the other. Oh, there's still a planning system, right? So, and actually people think that people want to be very idiosyncratic. If you actually look at the custom build industry, people don't want to be idiosyncratic, right? We all love, actually, ask architects, most architects where they live, and they say, I live in a Georgian house, and they all look the same, right?
Yeah.
So... actually, you can set really tight rules. But even if I said to you, look, there's a thing over there you can buy that's a one-size-fits-all box and you can buy it for £500,000, or over there there's a plot of land and there's a set of rules setting the exact materials and the shape of the outside house that you must make.
Mm.
But by the way, you can buy that plot of land for, you know, £150,000 and then build your own house at your leisure. Which would you go for?
Yeah.
So that you can set really tight rules, that's not a problem.
Okay, well, I'm sold on WikiHouse. I'm sold on the idea. How do people make any money from it then?
So we're flipping back. Let's not confuse these conversations.
Okay,
here, right?
Yeah,
we're talking about the,
I'm really talking
the
about
shift
you, yeah.
in housing production to the idea that actually direct procurement of housing by the end users,
yeah.
which, of course, WikiHouse is one example of, but there's loads out there. You know, and there will be hopefully many, many more companies and many more inventors and designers will come up with wonderful, brilliant ways to help people do that. The particularity of WikiHouse, of course, is that it leverages open source operations. And so there's a kind of myth that if you open source things, you can't make any money. Well, it's certainly not the case in software industry.
I guess that stems a bit from Spotify being a perfect case in point. Just that whole almost freemium model.
Yeah.
That
open source is not freemium. It's a very, very different thing. So it's open source is saying there's a basic myth that architects sell their knowledge. They don't. They sell their time. They sell their capacity to solve problems. And so you think, oh, I'm giving away all the thing. People won't hire an architect. Well, it's not how it works. Actually, the more information you give away, the more people can now afford to come knocking on the door and say, actually, I want you to hire you. But instead of hiring you, you know, for 6 months, which I couldn't afford to do before, I can now afford to hire you for 2 weeks. And now it's just you work for lots of clients, right? So that's one way you're actually selling to an expanded marketplace. At the moment, architecture only sells its services to a very, very narrow group of very rich people. Well, we don't yet sell our services to the middle classes, and we could. So that's one argument for that, is the expanded market argument. It's also straightforward economic efficiency. So we are sitting there in these offices resolving the same problems again and again. And we know that architecture's problem right now is that you have unpaid interns sitting there drawing 2D detail drawings. Down the road in another architecture office, there's another unpaid intern doing the same detail drawing. And it's, by the way, that detail drawing has been done hundreds of times before, better. But, you know, you tell me an architect who lies on their deathbed going, damn, I wish I'd spent more of my life redrawing the details and worrying about whether they were going to work or not. What you actually want is to have a common library, a common language where you can just go to, draw on it. You know that it's instantly, it's the latest, best possible version of that technology because it's being developed by an R&D team of thousands of your peers. You can solve the problem in half an hour and move on to the next project, or spend more time working with the client, thinking about the, you know, their problems, like do they need an extra room for the dog, or whatever, you know, whatever it might be, on the stuff that designers are actually good at. And by the way, you can charge the same fee, right? So which would you rather have? Like at the moment, architecture is this incredibly narrow marketplace, you know, Daniel Dendriss put it rather brilliantly, you know, only about 2% of the buildings in the world have anything to do with architects, right? That's a terrible market share. Quite aside from the ethical and moral implications of what that actually means, it means that architecture is this really narrow kind of thing. It's like, well, no, if we want to be more useful to more people in society, we need to be much more efficient in the way that we work. And so to open source stuff is not that it's not a hamper on your ability to make money. It's a huge shared com platform because it means you're no longer having to rewrite the wheel every time you do anything. And this, I love to quote the Linus Torvalds thing about be lazy like a fox. Don't reinvent the wheel every single time. And that's the craziness about what we're doing in architecture right now. We're if you explain the architectural process to somebody who works in, say, industrial design or product design, they'll say, hold on a minute. You're doing every single project as a prototype. Because you see what I mean? You're developing everything for the first time. Yeah. It's like, well, that's a terrible way to get things done.
Yeah.
So there are some basic underlying economics to the way that we work. And open source is not a threat to them. It's actually the solution.
And I guess it's a difficult problem. It's a difficult loop to get out of because a client will want to see something unique, I guess, or something, especially because the market is so not saturated, yeah, but so competitive that they want, if I'm a client spending X millions amount of pounds, I want something spectacular. But that's just because if we were to go, no, we've done this before, there you go. I'm not saying in any way I disagree. I guess I'm just playing devil's advocate in my head.
Depends what client you want and what they're selling, right? But even when you're doing a project, when you do a project, you're not redoing everything. You're not reinventing the bolt and the screw, right? You're using those that they already exist, right? So you're building on bits that already exist, and it's just you're doing a new thing with that language. Language is built on top of other languages, built on top of a language. So it's just you choosing, well, how much of the language does your client want you to completely reinvent this time round? And actually, if there's a model where, and this, you know, I'm not saying Wikihouse is the solution to all things, it's just one particular approach to how we could make houses in a fundamentally different, more bottom-up way, is it just a way to say, look, there's this common building language which allows you to design using this language, and all the details, everything are already done, they're already perfect. The costings come out automatically because the information is all up to date because we collectively decide to share it. There is no value in us all sitting here collectively sort of siloing our little bits of knowledge, saying, well, I've got 1/10 of the solution. And the other person, well, I've got 1/10. It's like, well, no, hold on. If we all shared them, we would all have all the solution all the time. And that's another way of thinking about the kind of what open source really means, which in a way is going, I'm going to contradict myself here. It's a way of moving to a design economy where no problem ever needs to be solved twice. Now, that's really interesting because it means that if you are a designer who, frankly, is being a little bit lazy and you make your money by just reselling the same kind of solution again and again and again, well, it is going to become harder for you to do that. You know, you'll be able to do that for a while, but actually it's going to become cheaper and cheaper and cheaper for someone else to do that. Well, that's going to happen anyway. WikiHouse isn't going to do that to you. Automation is coming. Yeah. Right, so that it's going to happen anyway. So the question we need to ask ourselves is how do these technologies come that have the most prosperity for the most of us, like the smartest, best way for us to collaborate and do all this together? It just seems self-evident that why would you do
I'm agreeing, by the way, that that I was having this chat with my mum on the weekend that I was going to sit down with you, and I was explaining WikiHouse, and she was. This is obviously pre my time, but she was saying that a very similar mindset was when the Apple Mac very first came out, and it had different type fonts. Mm. And at the time, you know, if you did type fonts and books and everything, this was a real panic for the whole industry. They thought, no one's going to need us anymore. And then it's like, well, no, this is just a tool.
Yeah.
And actually, it's very similar again. I was just thinking of all the different industries where this has constantly been a problem.
Yeah.
But it's not. You just come up with more creative ideas. But I think there's an element of fear that comes along with embracing the fact that all the creative knowledge that you've that's your currency, isn't it?
I think of it the other way around, which is, as you say, just think about the tools that you have to be creative with. Right. Yeah. As I said, no architect lies on their deathbed saying, oh, I wish I'd spent more time at the drudgery bit.
Yeah. Right. But do you not think you can understand?
Doing door schedules.
Oh, door schedules. Right? Yeah. If there could be an automated door schedule.
Yeah, exactly. Right. No one does that. Whereas someone was saying, well, hold on a minute. I've got these amazing tools and they're just smarter tools. They're just the cleverest tool. And so, you know, Wikipedia didn't have to argue against Britannica or Encarta, right? It just outperformed it. And people say, oh, yeah, but you put Britannica and Encarta out of business. Sure, but Wikipedia might have put two enterprises out of business, but they've put millions of enterprises into business.
Yeah.
Because that knowledge wants to be shared, right? And there are some things that want to be shared. But so the WikiHouse, when you drill it down, people say, oh, it's plywood. No, it's not plywood. It's this idea of a shared common building language that can be digitally manufactured at very low cost, at very high performance. But behind that even, actually, it's a set of principles. And I think there are 13 now. You can go to the website and you can see them, and each one's got a little picture. And one of those principles is that knowledge should be free, but people's time should always be paid for, right? And that is a really good, solid principle. And that is actually an economy where, when you get down to it, most designers say, yeah, that's an economy in which I want to work in, where people aren't trying to hoard their ideas and it's just silly, right? And also, by the way, architects of all the architecture of all the industries has the least to fear in this regard, because we never really controlled our IP anyway. Like, look at Detail Magazine. Right, we've already been sharing it badly for a long time. That is not what we sell. There's amazingly few IP cases in architecture, because architecture is the industry of copying. And before architecture,
yeah, right?
I mean, classical architecture, what is that? Oh, it's a bunch of rich kids going over to Italy, doing the grand tour and copying. Right, architecture is all about copying. You go into any architecture school and you'll see students there with copies of the AR or whatever open, and they're copying, like, aesthetically, very sophisticated way. They're copying, resynthesizing, remixing. That's what they do. That's what, you know, but for a particular use or for a particular question or a particular purpose. And So the irony of architecture is that we have this myth of originality, and it's not what we're good at. And actually, even beyond architecture, you know, the 2% of the buildings, and look at the other 98% of the buildings throughout most of history, vernacular. I would say vernacular and open source are the same thing. The idea, you know, I think, look at the sash window, right? We all love the sash window. And if you look at the sash window as a design, it's a brilliant piece of design. It's evolved. It does... It kills 100 birds with one stone, right? It issues ventilation, light, maintenance, material economy, you know, all kinds of things. And it's evolved slowly. No one person invented the sash window. It was many, many people contributed to it. And yet we all benefit from it. Now, there's still plenty of people still now in London making money by manufacturing and selling sash windows. Mm. And they're still earning a perfectly good living.
Yeah. So
our kind of... You know, that so vernacular, actually, in some ways, I think what we're going, this, it's been described that the third industrial revolution is in some ways a kind of leapfrogging. We should be able to look back at this sort of rather centralized, dumb, one-size-fits-all era of industrial modernity, if you like, as a kind of slightly awkward adolescent phase. And actually, we're getting, you can see that with Wikihouse, the idea of the barn raising. You can see that we're actually going back to those vernacular models, the output of which everybody loves. You know, if everyone goes skiing, they stay in the chalets, right? It's vernacular architecture.
Yeah.
Go to Ibiza, oh, they stay in the back, vernacular architecture, right? But we're going back to them with the ingenuity and the creativity and the technology and the tools with iPhones in our hands.
Yeah.
Right? And that's really, really amazing. That's a really interesting time to be alive. Right?
Yeah, so we went to Austria a couple of weeks ago and stayed in this absolutely gorgeous valley. And every single house and building was identical. And that was just because the locally produced wood was pine, so everything was made out of pine. But that vernacular was locally sourced material. And bricks are locally sourced material. So it's kind of... And I like the idea that... rapid prototype stuff, we can fight it all we want, but it will get so cheap so quickly. I mean,
it's what Jeremy Rifkin calls the zero margin society, so the zero marginal cost society.
Yeah, because on the ramp on the way down, you saw we've got like 6 or 8 rapid prototype machines. Ken wants to bump that up to 100 apparently. But that kind of relentless ability to just create whatever you want whenever you want, it means that why would I pay 50 quid for something beautifully manufactured out of timber when I can pay £2 and have it done that night. So it comes down to like loving that material, I guess.
Exactly. And this is the weird thing, is that when you, you know, you look at it, it's a weird hybrid of craft and anti-craft. So, and that's the weird thing, because in some ways the CNC machine seems like to kill the notion of craft, but on another level, suddenly you're back to the idea of the local person in their workshop coming up with really beautiful things that there's been thousands of hours of love and attention going into them. So it's like, well, what is this? It's not as straightforward. And actually, there's some really literal examples of that. If you look into the grammar of the WikiHouse system right now, there are joints stolen from 14th century Japanese wood. Okay, you know, and I always joke, we haven't yet heard from their lawyers.
yet
so that's the first thing. Of course, you know, there's room for everything, and actually architecture has always been, frankly, for the last 100 or 200 years ago, since, you know, it really existed as a profession, it's been pretty ambivalent about all the other buildings. You know, Pevsner very snobbishly said, you know, the Lincoln Cathedral's architecture and a bike shed is just a building. Well, it turns out bike sheds actually really fascinating and beautiful, and turns out pretty important if you're interested in stuff like climate change, etc. And so that's one element of it. But I think it's not just us kind of going, oh, this is kind of fun. And it's also saying, no, there is a market and an economic shift in here, in the way that designers work and the way that we contribute to society and earn a living by doing so. So the next phase of WikiHouse is that really it's been built by this amazing community of passionate, brilliant inventors, designers, architects. I can go on about who they are for hours, but there's a huge mix of people. And they're really, at the current stage, they're the passionate sort of inventors or tinkerers or prototypers. And I think it's now the first WikiHouse technology is obviously the chassis, you know, technology that you can see, the bit made out of plywood. There are other WikiHouse technologies beginning to come through now, like windows, like heat recovery ventilators, all kinds of interesting things. But that's now at a point now where it's commercially usable. And so the next challenge of the project is to build around the project an open marketplace of architects and manufacturers and contractors and engineers and lenders and maybe insurers and all those other professional roles making a living using the system. And that's our kind of the next, I think the next chapter of WikiHouse's journey, which is why we set up just under a year or so ago, we set up WikiHouse Foundation as a non-profit foundation, which gives us the power, gives us a platform to work with many companies in order to try and do that. So everything that we develop, everything that WikiHouse's community produces belongs to you. It belongs to all of us.
Because this brings me nicely round to what I'll kind of, we'll kind of finish on like your work at Zero Zero and things. But as an example, if I've tinkered for a week and I've made this fantastic thing that I'm really, really proud of, and it's a week of my time, then essentially you're saying, well, then you put it on and it's free for everyone to download. And it's, and I guess how, let's use you as an example, then how do you monetize or survive and have
In the straightforward sense, the same way you always do, which is, so take the example of the house that's about to get built. Architectures, that was a commission with Architecture 00. The client approached Architecture 00, make us a house, same thing, design fee, etc. Now all the files will then be out for free, but Architecture 00 still make their fee. And of course, what happens is suddenly the phone starts ringing, and 100 other people say, "Hey, I want a house, but I don't want the exact same house." Because if you want the exact same house, you can have that for free. That's fine. Go knock yourself out. But they say, "Well, no, I don't want the exact same house. I want a slight design change for my needs." Or the other person says, "Well, I want the exact same house, but by the way, I want another manufacturer, so another manufacturer earns their living." So it's a total myth that someone's losing out. Everyone's still making the same money in the same way they normally were, because that's not what architecture was selling, right?
But do you not have clients who say, "Hang on, you're giving me a replica house"? Not that every other Georgian house isn't a replica anyway, but you've kind of made me just think in my own head that I'm literally just
think aloud. I think aloud.
Yeah. I was just about to go, "Yeah, but why couldn't I have a Georgian house and I can have this?" But you're like, "Well, the Georgian house will cost you a lot more because it's made out of more expensive materials," right?
But I'm dying for someone to make a kind of faux Georgian house using the WikiHouse system, actually.
There's the challenge.
I think it'll happen. I mean, it would be a bit silly, of course, because, that idea of vernacular, whatever, it's not just something to use lightly. Architects love to wax lyrical about that kind of thing. But if you think really hard about what that is, it's about the idea that the beauty of something, etc., it all comes from the hyper pragmatism behind it. And so, of course, things begin to develop their own,
So you work at Zero Zero, but you also run WikiHouse.
Yeah, so Zero Zero is, a lot of people, as of understandably, don't understand Zero Zero. I joined Zero Zero. It's a sort of collaborative studio of many disciplines. So not just architects, we've got researchers, sociologists, all kinds of people.
Oh, really?
It's essentially, it's Zero Zero is best understood as a kind of ecosystem of companies. So there's Architecture Zero Zero is just one of the companies in Zero Zero, which is obviously they produce architecture, they're an architecture firm, but there's also lots of other companies, and that includes WikiHouse Foundation, it includes OpenDesk, includes Doolabs, Civic Systems Lab. So there's a bunch of other companies all in this ecosystem together. And again, that's a whole other conversation for another day I'm sure you could speak to Indy about, and he'd be much more eloquent than I would about it. But about the changing way that we work, we're moving from this thing where you had to be a big super company to get anything done, to saying, no, actually you can exist in ecosystems where you have a basic rule, and actually you have a basic platform that says, no, go and create value within this platform, rather than being completely stuck out there on your own as an entrepreneur. So, and it means that as members of Zero Zero, we have the power to go out, come up with new innovations, and spin out the enterprises and the companies that come with them. And I think that's important, because if we're serious about words like industrial revolution, etc., these are not just technological questions. They come with different business models. these new technological models come with different supply chains, and the different supply chains come with different business models, and the different business models come with different governance models. And we've seen that from the web, right? The web has profoundly changed some of the concepts behind notions of ownership and even things like money now and things like Bitcoin. So, and that's obviously something that as strategic designers, we take really, really seriously. So we are, when we are working on and contributing to a project like WikiHouse, we're not just thinking about it as a hardware question. We are also thinking about the economics behind it, how people earn a living, the business models, you know, what should and shouldn't be owned by whom, et cetera, et cetera.
So if client comes to you, you form the design, again, I'm just thinking out loud here, and then they go, well, I want a balcony and I want an extra and a garage, but a garage coming off the side, and then you tweak and develop the WikiHouse design to include those elements.
Do. Yeah.
I do, yes. So, but at 0-0, say this is...
Let's say it's Make. Let's say Make set up a WikiHouse team tomorrow, which would be great.
Interesting.
There's a few big architects, actually, who are beginning to get really interested in whether this that way of working could sustain a, you know, lucrative sub-business within them. It's got the kind of micro fee.
Well, okay, let's definitely reverse this totally on me.
So let's reverse this the other way around.
And then I've developed this extending garage and a balcony and a dormer window and everything. Then do I then put that straight back out into the system for everyone to use and go, look, Make have done this fantastic extension. This is parametric garage option. And it comes out. Then... that to me kind of, I'm not saying it's wrong, I'd be like, but
no, so that's our, that? So that, well, no, though, so that's our, that's actually our, you've literally described our vision. So what we're trying to build is not just the kind of the Wikipedia library, if you like, where those files will be shared for other people to immediately start riffing on, building on, but actually, and they'll be badged, by the way, with your authorship, etc. But actually to create, what we're trying to build is a kind of app store for the construction world, if you like, for the micro construction world. So
a nicely digestible idea, isn't it?
Right. So this idea that you can actually go out, we'll create a common marketplace. We're calling it the WikiHouse catalog. But there'll be a catalog there of products and services and providers. And so actually, you will then list your what was it? A balcony on a garage, or whatever your that innovation that you've come. So you will then develop that and you will then list it in the catalogue. So you will then be in the WikiHouse catalogue as a certified provider. And again, that's a key thing. It's like anyone can take the IP and use it, but the trademark of WikiHouse is controlled. So for example, if you want to be able to do it as a WikiHouse thing, when you say, well, we are a WikiHouse provider, then you could, then you, and so actually that's what people want.
So do you curate what's on the WikiHouse catalog then, as in who?
Yeah, it will be created. And I mean, and we're still in the early days, I think, as we move from being just a community of people developing things, people saying, no, actually there's quite a few groups and companies within the WikiHouse community saying, no, we want to earn a living by becoming a WikiHouse provider. We are together with them going to work out what that looks like and what that means, but certainly there will be an element of curation in terms of all the design files will be there, but actually not all of them will be there in sort of integrated into a system that will be kind of curated by a group of people. And again, in future that might be something that can be opened up as well. So we're seeing where that leads. And I think, again, rather than that's not going to be a kind of closed thing, actually the principles upon which we're doing that are hopefully really, really clear, because it's really important that on one level WikiHouse is trying to be as aesthetically agnostic as possible, but actually there's a certain level of quality and performance and making sure that those 13 principles are really embedded into absolutely every aspect of each design.
So is the idea that someone uses a WikiHouse design, there's an inherent level of quality?
Yes.
And if you build it as per that drawing, you don't take responsibility.
Well, and there's different layers. So you can go there, and so let's take the example of a window in the future. Let's say there's a WikiHouse window in there that can be, it's a very high performance window. The files are all there. So if you want to, you can go in there, you can get those files absolutely for free. You can go and put it in. You've got to do all the work of manufacturing it yourself, installing it yourself, and you don't know whether it's going to work. The other option is you say, well, actually, I want a company who's going to manufacture it for me. But they're not providing any certification or warranties with it, but they're just going to manufacture it for me. I'm going to assemble the kit. Another version is where you get a complete assembled service, and by the way, they will stamp that. And they'll have three different price points, and it's up to you. You can have whichever you want. But it doesn't cost you as a designer anything when people just take the files and do it for themselves. It's like, fine, it doesn't cost you anything because those people weren't going to hire you anyway. So, that's actually the kind of future that we're looking at. And it will be shifting goalposts because more and more people will go, well, hold on, do I need to certify my window? Because I can just put it in a sensor and I know whether it's working or not. So,
yeah, I guess with the Internet of Things coming up as well, the idea of real-time feedback
exactly.
And
then, of course, the idea of everyone sees WikiHouse now as, the digitally manufactured chassis technology. But again, there's been some really, really interesting experiments we do with some guys at Arups. Sarah, the WikiHouse Foundation, is sort of hosting and creating some of these really interesting innovations around plug-and-play smart homes. And how those technologies also become open and interoperable and plug and play within the home as well.
I guess the advantage that you've got, as the way I see it, is that on a worldwide platform, I was just thinking, well, if it stagnates and someone goes, well, why should I go that extra step and design something new and original and put it on there, when in actual fact everyone will just steal that and no one will come to me.
Hopefully the marketplace, the catalogue thing would flip that a little bit, because you say, no, actually, hold on, that's a great way to then, I've put my thing out there, now people will come to buy it to me to buy it off me.
But I was just thinking on a worldwide platform.
But also you can kind of relax, because we're not going to run out of design problems anytime soon, right? If as a society we've run out of design problems, we can all go to the pub anyway. So, and we don't need to earn salaries. So,
I think it's more that I love the idea so much. I'm literally just trying to pick holes in it, and I can't. Everything you said is completely true. I genuinely think that in the right.
Let's stay here another hour.
Yeah.
We'll find them.
But so we've crashed straight past the hour mark, because I knew I'd really enjoy doing this, but. I will wrap things up now. But you said the app. So what's kind of next for WikiHouse then? I mean, how much of your time at 00 is kind of dedicated to design and architecture? Mm. And not that WikiHouse isn't, but I guess you must do a lot of this. You must publicize and talk and, you know, kind of advertise WikiHouse, you know.
We've never advertised it.
But you know what I mean,
we'll do these sort of conversations and stuff, but no, we've never had to do that, right? We don't think we should just do something good and it's the right thing and people believe in it, then, you know, people are not people to be hammered at and sold to. They're a resource, you know, they're a resource to be in your team, in your community. In terms of my time, I mean, a lot of people in the foundation are still part-time, and that's quite nice in some ways, because they flip out. So part of the time will be working in an architecture firm or whatever firm, or, you know, a startup developing the kind of products, which are then open source. But then they're also helping build this common foundation in the center. I think we're definitely, the next stage is, as the project has reached a stage of maturity, we know we need to go out and build a digital platform. And that's a really... And to build this supply chain, this marketplace, you know, and we'd like to get to a point where we have, you know, a good number of WikiHouse providers in the UK and beyond in a year or so. And that's a really interesting journey that we're on, really, just kind of working out what that looks like. None of us signed up to be we're not natural business people or anything like that. So we're kind of working that out. And I think one of the big questions that is quite radical is, I've lost count of how many times we've had venture capitalists or whatever come up to me or one of us and say, this is great, I want to invest. And we say, we can't. We've put it under the ownership of this foundation, whose job it is just to be the custodian. So it belongs to everyone forever. But we also want to build digital infrastructure. So we're totally dependent on first donations from kind of supporters and contributions. And most of it's built by contributions in the community. But on the long run, we're like, no, that doesn't work. So on the long run, we say, well, we can build in a revenue model around a marketplace model. So it'll be just like any other digital marketplace. The difference will be that it'll be a non-profit at its core. The more interesting is, how do you raise capital? And there's this real mindset right now, which is, the Silicon Valley model, which is you raise capital and then it's owned, but, you know, by a kind of one company in California. And we're like, well, we'd like to you know, the whole approach, we like to raise capital without doing that. So what we're now doing is we're going and we're speaking to a range of companies and organizations and institutions, public and private and everything in between, and saying, look, collectively, and either directly or indirectly, you have a really strong value incentive for this to exist. Now, you don't need to own it to see value in it. And there's lots of companies. An obvious example would be a company that sells plywood right now, obviously, right? They're going to sell more plywood if this exists. So, but actually, we don't have one of those as our partners at the moment. But actually, we do have other ones, you know, companies we're talking to and other partners coming on board who are interested in either the value of good housing or the scale of this distributed market. You know, if I say, well, where is the next, you know, £1 billion going to come from in your kind of future market, it's going to come from the micro construction industry, the citizen sector, which, by the way, builds most houses throughout most of the world always. So what we're trying to do, with some success, I think, is get a circle of partner companies on board to say, no, look, if all of us put in a chunk of money each, we can build this digital platform together. And that's kind of where, to be brutally honest, that's exactly what we're doing right now, and saying, look, we want people to invest in this, but we want to invest in it based on the reason why it works in the first place, which is because it's open. And then also to be based not on the basis that you don't need to own it, you don't need to monopolize this, invest on the basis of value. So, you know, because making it cheaper and easier to make sustainable, affordable housing, if you're a housing association, is going to make your life 100 times easier. So invest on the basis of that. You know, if you're an insurance company, it's going to reduce your payouts in the future. So invest on the basis of that. If you're a company that sells materials and tools directly to citizens, well, obviously the citizen sector is going to be really good for you for that. So, wanting to talk to those kind of companies and say, look, together we get around the thing and say we have a really strong incentive in an economy. And actually, by the way, architecture is one of those, because at the moment architecture is we're massively underperforming. You know, we can run to China and try and make some money from off the old model playing out there, and then it will crash. Right. But actually, there's a huge opportunity for us to kind of drag ourselves into the 21st century and start selling our design services, et cetera, in a different way.
I guess it must be so exciting just to feel that momentum building.
It is. And I think, I mean, one of the, there's a thing, I think it was probably Linus Torvalds who said a thing about if you are the founders of an open source project, your essential job description, your purpose is to make yourself unemployed as quickly as possible, to make yourself unnecessary. And then you go and do something else. And I, you know, so many people have put so much work into building this, and every step it goes, sure, it's been slow. It's been slower than it would have been if we'd had, you know, £1 million and et cetera, overnight. But even though it goes slowly, I just feel this amazing sense of optimism, because you just go, history is coming in our direction.
Yeah.
More and more people already want to work in this way. And the closer we get, just you get this really joyful sense of inevitability that this will happen in one form or another. And it might not be called WikiHouse, you know, down the line, someone else might do it better, and that's fine. But actually, this fundamental approach, this different way of working, it will exist in the future in some form, because it works, and it has to.
I guess as well, you're at such an exciting point, because it's such, I guess you're still in such an infancy of where you're planning to go.
Yeah, which is weird, because of course we've been going 3 years, right, from the first initial experiments.
Wow, I bet that's gone quickly, hasn't it? 3 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so, I think that...
But it is still infancy, yeah.
To have your name attached to a piece of the WikiHouse design, say you designed one part of it, or Mike's...
Which I could do, by the way, right now, because it's still small enough that I could list off a list of 10 people around the world who have contributed significant.
And then
part.
Imagine... Because every architect, I guess why we want to design airports and skyscrapers, you want the max amount of people to see what you've done, right? I guess that's the dream, isn't it? But imagine seeing the... like a city of wiki, like a town of wiki houses, and knowing that that little detail there, that was me.
Yeah.
That'd be amazing, or, I guess. Or,
kind of, yeah, that part of, yeah, exactly.
And I guess there's kind of, you've already designed it in such a way that you can kind of, you can build it without scaffolding, kind of build it as you go up it, right? So there's kind of all these really interesting leaps that make you just think, well, how many stories, how
high? And the beauty is, of course, is that then someone else comes along and improves the next one. And as I said, it never needs to be solved again. Yeah. And actually, that's one of the reassuring things. So when you're sitting there, it's, you know, late at night, and you're doing the most mundane little design detail. And I think when you're working on WikiHows, is actually because we, at some point, somebody is going all the way down to, you're thinking almost more like an industrial designer, because you know everything about the screw, you know, everything about the, you know, everything really. And up to a point, so then somebody needs to know nothing, right? But the power is, you're there and it's late at night and whatever, you're working on a thing and you're solving the most mundane problem imaginable. But the reassuring thing that you say is, this is great, because no one ever is going to have to do this again. And so suddenly you flip from this world where, from the too damn difficult world, where people say, oh, it's not scalable. If you want to do things efficiently, it's got to be massive, big and top down. And that's the only thing that will ever succeed. Suddenly you flip that. And that way of working suddenly looks incredibly clunky, actually, because you realize that in this kind of emergent bottom-up thing, only one person has to do something once, and it's done forever for everyone. And it's a really optimistic way of working, because you go, actually, yeah, no, that will work on the long run eventually.
Yeah. And also, you'll get to a point, I guess, however long that's someone's waiting for that thing to be solved, and then that next step is solved, and then suddenly there's a massive leapfrog.
I'm still waiting. I'm waiting for the. I mean, seriously. I mean, there's people doing really mind blowing stuff, in kind of around WikiHouse right now, and I'm just like, I've seen it. Like, I know it's coming, and you know, I'm like, I'm just waiting.
So, where can people find out? If they want to go, well, what are you working on? What's the next thing?
Yeah,
like, so where do I find the files? Like, where do I find all
this? Yeah, so go to wikihouse.cc. It's still a very basic website. Please, obviously, donate to support us. If you'd like to partner with us, do partner, get in contact with us. You can always follow WikiHouse on Twitter, which is just at WikiHouse. And Harry is our community host, and he's just an amazing guy, and he just talks to everybody and connects everybody to everybody else. You can do that. In terms of actually getting started, if you're a designer, the commons at the moment is actually just a massive Google Drive folder, and through the website you can go on and you can join the commons, that's a big repo, and there's a folder in there called the Get Started folder, and it has the basic information that you need, the basic files and the basic guides that will get you into starting to work with, and before you know it, you'll be modeling and go, oh no, I can see how that could be better, I can improve that, and then you'll start a project file, and before you know it, you'll be away.
And you send that back to you and then say,
it's all shared in the drive, so everybody can see what everyone else is doing. It's all a big mess, right? Because there's loads of folders and the projects are at different stages, and that's why we want to build a more sophisticated digital platform to help deal with that. But actually there's some basic core resources there ready for you to go to get started. And we've also created a structure where, the first thing we did was we opened up chapters. So anyone can start up a WikiHouse chapter. So a chapter is not a commercial trading entity. It's an open meetup group anywhere in the world. And I think there's now 22 chapters around the world. And the first one, and still one of the most exciting and most advanced, is WikiHouse New Zealand in Christchurch. But they're all over the place now. The recent one started in India, which is a real challenge. Because the current technology, the principles work in India, but the technology doesn't. So that's going to be a long play. But so open that up, and so you can do that. You can apply to start a chapter if you want to. You can start WikiHouse High Wycombe if you want to. It doesn't matter. I think, then the next stage will be those designers who started playing with it and they've made some prototypes with it. We had Miller Howard workshop, did one a couple of weeks ago, and they said, oh, well, I've just fallen in love with this system. And I think a lot of architects and designers and supply manufacturers begin to go through that circle and going, okay, now we've done one, we're interested in starting to use this commercially. And at that point also, we want to hear from you, because we'd love to work with the first few companies who are really going to start saying, no, let's build this way of working.
I'm smiling because I'm literally just thinking, right, the first thing I want to find out, is there a wiki shed? And then I was thinking, well, maybe I can just
there's
scale.
There's a studio.
Is there?
There's a little garden studio, which is one unit. It needs upgrading to the latest version 4.2 of the language. But it was really funny, actually, because it was first developed by Architecture 00, shared onto the thing, and we just put it as a placeholder on the catalogue, really, because we were just sort of building that approach. And so it was useful to have that and just put it there. What was weird is that one didn't get built by Architecture 00 first. The first one to be built was actually built by the WikiHouse Vienna chapter earlier this summer, which is quite funny, this kind of world where you can produce a design and then someone else will actually test it first and then send you back all the details and say, this doesn't work. We have quite a lot of moments like that where, Thursday night your engineer will call up and say, we've discovered a problem with this joint, we don't know how it performs. And Friday morning you'll come up with a different variant that says, well, how about this? And this says, well, yeah, but you got to test it. So you send the files up. Chop Shop is one of the manufacturers up in Sheffield. They'll cut a little test piece on Friday afternoon, and then by Friday evening you've got your answer. And actually it just went over hundreds of miles and three different teams at once. And then you think,
amazing, isn't it?
Oh, that's so cool. I just, those are the little moments I just think that's cool.
That's wicked, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then so I'll wrap this up and say thank you, but I'm thinking that would make an amazing puzzle. I'm thinking, like, like a Meccano set. I'm just thinking, my dad loves building those type of things. I'll just get him a 1 to 10 scale of WikiHouse, and then we've got the laser cutters here. I just make a puzzle pack.
Try it.
No,
try
I
it.
Really want to.
Well, and then what you should do, right, is make those little puzzles and then sell them as toys and on the thing. And so people could buy little WikiHouse kits, and you can make money out of open source information.
I think we've pretty much just thought of having to make my millions until people find out they can do it themselves in laser cut, and I'll be like, damn it.
You'd be amazed, because actually what, if you look at what digital platforms sell, they sell convenience. So even though people can do it themselves, not everybody wants to, right? And that's the point. And actually, more broadly, the idea of custom build, people think, oh, self-build, I've got to build it myself. And no, it's not. It's actually creating a system and a marketplace in which you choose how much you want to do for yourself. And by the way, you don't have to do any of it yourself. You can just put money in and get it if you want to, but you just pay a little bit more. And I think that's, yeah.
Well, I'm sold. So thank you so much for doing this interview. That was fantastic.
No, thank you. It's been
fun.
That was episode 6 of the Create More podcast with Alistair Parvin. I think you can all agree we went to some serious depth about the WikiHouse there. I think the whole idea of kind of open source, kind of creative information is something that I'm really, really interested in. I mean, if you think of how this podcast is released, this idea of kind of an open community and this kind of open source architecture. I mean, this podcast is done, you know, this podcast wouldn't have been possible 5 years ago, you know, without me paying a lot of money or going through one of the big establishments. And I think that's Alistair's kind of, that's what's so interesting about the WikiHouse, is that there's no, instead of having one centralized kind of place to produce and design, we kind of filter that down and decentralize to the point where anyone has the abilities. I mean, this podcast alone, I've done it. I'm at home. I'm currently just recording this on my laptop. This thing gets put out onto a worldwide accessible database, which anyone can download for free. You know, you can go on iTunes and you can type in Create More and my podcast pops up along with like the BBC and other podcasts. I don't quite have the same listening figures, sure. But I just find that amazing, that kind of that we're in this time where that's possible. And I think especially with architecture, I think this whole idea is just one that, you know, Alistair explained so clearly. It's exciting. And you can tell by the way he talks that he's incredibly passionate about it. I mean, this is really, it feels like his calling type thing, doesn't it? And I just think that he's just a very engaging person to listen to. And I really hope you enjoyed that. And please, it would make me so happy if someone just from listening to this podcast went and did or built a WikiHouse design. So if you do and you have, please send me a photo on my Twitter account @PlaidStudio, because I would love to see that. I mean, I'm genuinely going to go look at it and download like one of their small houses and try and build it on our laser cut plywood machine to work. I mean, it does sound like the ultimate jigsaw, which actually sounds like a pretty damn good idea. So you heard it here first, not that anyone can't steal it from me, but yeah, I really, really hope you enjoyed that podcast. And, you know, let me know if you did, or is there anyone else you want me to interview or think of stuff? But on to next fortnight's podcast, I was very fortunate to sit down with Mr. Ken Shuttleworth, who is the founder of Make Architects. And well, come on, who doesn't want to sit down with their own boss for an hour and interview them in a small room? I feel it was a nice bit of role reversal from about 5 years ago to the week where I first started to Make. So I really enjoyed doing that as well. And yeah, so that comes out in 2 weeks' time. So thank you so much for listening. If you've enjoyed it, share it. Please let me know. And I will, next podcast comes out soon. So thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.